The Iranian regime has told Sky News, if you put boots on the ground in Iran, it will be another Vietnam. Are you afraid of that?
No, I'm not afraid of... I'm really not afraid of anything.
Mr. President!
He needs to explain to the American people what the justification is, what his plan is, and when are we going to get out of this war? Because the American people do not want yet another forever war.
The war in Iran escalates with more major Iranian hits on neighboring countries' oil infrastructure, a continued chokehold on the Strait of Hormuz, and a U.S. amphibious assault ship with 2,500 Marines on board sails to the region. With the U.S.-Israeli war against Iran raging, Pope Leo XIV's calls for peace become more urgent.
He understands that we are living in apostolic times that needs that missionary spirit.
A change at the top of the Archdiocese of Denver, we are in Colorado for an on-the-record interview with outgoing Archbishop Samuel Aquila. And the patron saint of Latin American bishops, inspired then Father Robert Prevost, we head to Peru to find out how Saint Toribio Mogrovejo influenced a future pope. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
A nome dei cristiani del Medio Oriente.
On behalf of the Christians of the Middle East and all the women and men of goodwill, I appeal to those responsible for this conflict. Cease fire. May paths of dialogue be reopened.
The best defense is a good offense, and so we're not afraid to go after and kill anybody, and we have a lot of them.
From the Vatican to the U.S. Defense Department, two very different world views on how to deal with world conflict and the U.S.-Israeli war with Iran. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. We are 3 weeks into a war in the Middle East that shows no signs of letting up. In fact, it is widening. Iran is retaliating with strikes on oil and gas facilities on neighboring Gulf countries. The war has triggered a global economic shock, and the U.S. is fast-tracking the deployment of an additional Marine unit based in San Diego to the Middle East, in addition to the one already steaming towards the Persian Gulf from its base in Okinawa, Japan. And now the Pentagon is asking Congress for $200 billion in supplemental funding to finance a very expensive war that's costing more than $1 billion a day.
$200 billion, I think that number could move, obviously. It takes money to kill bad guys. So we're going back to Congress and our folks there to ensure that we're properly funded for what's been done, for what we may have to do in the future.
A $200 billion supplemental for a war that has never been approved by Congress, with lowball estimates on the current cost to Americans and the potential for misinterpreting or spinning it as approval of the war, seems to me a non-starter.
As the war continues, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said this week U.S. forces continue to attack deeper into Iranian territory. Warplanes continue to hunt and sink Iranian boats, and more than 5,000 pounds of bombs have been dropped on underground weapon storage facilities. In the meantime, Iran is raising the stakes in the war as it intensifies attacks on oil and natural gas facilities around the Gulf. Those strikes are sending fuel prices soaring and risk drawing Iran's Arab neighbors directly into the conflict. Among multiple targets across the region, Iranian drones hit a key Saudi oil refinery on the Red Sea, which it had hoped to utilize to avoid sending oil through the Strait of Hormuz. And Iranian missiles caused extensive damage to a major liquefied natural gas facility in Qatar, which could delay getting supplies to market even after the war is over. The chokehold continues in the all-important Strait of Hormuz, through which 20% of the world's oil supply is transported out of the Persian Gulf. That is being felt in the world economy. In the U.S., gas prices are up an average of 97 cents per gallon since the war began. Airlines are bracing for increased jet fuel costs. And trucking companies that rely on diesel are projecting big hikes in shipping costs that will have an impact on everything delivered by truck, including food. Much of the world's fertilizer comes through the strait, and agriculture experts say farmers around the globe risk crop failure without it, impacting food security for millions of people. The International Maritime Organization is also concerned about the 3,000 ships stuck in the Persian Gulf and 20,000 sailors who are currently trapped on their vessels.
Every single country around the world is being affected by this conflict, so everybody has a role to play in order to get to the point where we don't only evacuate these vessels and the seafarers in particular, but we actually reinstate the freedom of navigation and the free passage and trade of all the ships in that area.
Maritime experts say about 90 ships have crossed the strait since the war began 3 weeks ago, mostly Iran's own oil tankers and vessels with ties to China, India and Pakistan, after those countries negotiated safe passage with Iran. That is still a vast decline from the roughly 120 vessels per day before the war. America's top counterterrorism official resigned this week over dissatisfaction with the Iran war. Joseph Kent, the director of the National Counterterrorism Center, said he could no longer in good conscience support the war. In his resignation letter, he said Iran posed no imminent threat to the U.S., and he believed the U.S. started the war because of pressure from Israel, a charge several of his critics have called anti-Semitic. Kent called war in the Middle East a trap. Kent's boss, Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard, was grilled on the Iran threat during 2 days of contentious hearings on Capitol Hill this week, along with CIA Director John Ratcliffe and FBI Director Kash Patel. And what is known as a worldwide threat assessment, which they are required by law to give to Congress, they were asked whether Iran posed an imminent threat to the U.S. before President Trump started the war.
This is the worldwide threats hearing where you present to Congress national intelligence, timely, objective, and independent of political considerations. You've stated today that the intelligence community's assessment is that Iran's nuclear enrichment program was obliterated and that, quote, there had been no efforts since then to try to rebuild their enrichment capability. Was it the intelligence community's assessment that, nevertheless, despite this obliteration, there was a, quote, imminent nuclear threat posed by the Iranian regime? Yes or no?
It is not the intelligence community's responsibility to determine what is and is not an imminent threat.
Okay.
That is up to the president.
Here's the problem.
Based on a volume of information that he receives.
It is precisely your responsibility to determine what constitutes a threat to the United States.
The intelligence team was further grilled about why the administration was not more fully prepared for the risks Iran posed if attacked and the likelihood it would retaliate by closing the Strait of Hormuz. Over the past few weeks, Pope Leo XIV has made strong pleas for peace in the Middle East. But as the war escalates, so too has the Holy Father's diplomatic rhetoric.
Buona domenica.
Pope Leo has often used his Sunday Angelus to reflect on conflicts and headlines. But this week, from his usual window in the Apostolic Palace, he used his strongest language yet on the war in the Middle East, directly addressing the leaders responsible and criticized the killing of thousands of civilians.
Violence can never lead to the justice, stability, and peace for which the peoples are waiting.
That same day, on a visit to a Rome parish, the Holy Father chastised leaders who use God's name to justify war, saying in a homily that, quote, God cannot be enlisted by darkness. Those comments echo a speech the Holy Father gave last Friday to priests attending an annual course on the formation of confessors. He asked Christians involved in the war to examine their conscience.
One might well ask, do those Christians who bear grave responsibility in armed conflicts have the humility and courage to make a serious examination of conscience and to go to confession?
Francis Rocca, Vatican editor for EWTN News, says Pope Leo's recent comments are more pointed than his previous ones, while still maintaining the Vatican tradition of diplomatic neutrality.
In this case, he still observed the convention of not explicitly calling out one of the sides and just calling for peace, you know, but he said Christians who are waging war ought to go to confession. So obviously in this war, the Christians are largely on one side.
These diplomatic comments about a conflict largely started by the U.S. come from the first U.S.-born pope.
And being the first U.S. pope, obviously anything he says is going to be looked at through that lens, and he knows that. He must know that.
On Monday, the pontiff redirected his comments from those who start wars to those who report them. In an audience with Italian broadcasters, Pope Leo challenged journalists to not spread propaganda and become a mouthpiece for those in power.
La guerra porta sempre le popolazioni.
It is up to you to show the sufferings that war always brings to the people, to show the face of war and to relate it through the eyes of the victims, so as not to transform it into a video game.
Since his pontificate began, the Holy Father has focused on building bridges. Even his first words as Pope invoked the peace of the risen Christ. He has often encouraged the faithful to pray for war-torn Ukraine and for peace in Gaza. But Rocha notes that popes only started acting as peacemakers in the 20th century.
In the 19th century, well, for one thing, war started to become industrial war, really, really large-scale killing in the U.S. Civil War. And then, of course, in the First World War in the early 20th century. Since then, certainly, popes have always stressed diplomacy and, more recently, multilateralism in the United Nations, which the Vatican has always supported.
Pope Leo's calls for dialogue over division in the Middle East are taking an increasingly urgent tone. And while he's still walking a fine diplomatic line, what can we glean from our Holy Father's approach to the war in Iran? For that, we turn to two experts who have roots in Rome and continue to closely monitor Vatican relations. Francis Rooney is the former ambassador to the Holy See. He served at the Vatican from 2005 to 2008 during the George W. Bush administration. He also served two terms in Congress, representing Florida's 19th congressional district. Inez San Martin is an Argentinian journalist who served as vice president of marketing and communications for the Pontifical Mission Societies and as the former Rome bureau chief of Crux, a news outlet focused on the Catholic Church. Thank you both for being here. I first want to gauge from you both how significant and how strong you consider the Holy Father's recent demand for a ceasefire in the Iran war. Ambassador, I'll start with you.
Well, I think it was a good statement. You need to carve out some turf with this guy. And as we know, the president only responds to strength. And I think the Pope coming out clearly and strongly, and also getting Cardinal Kupich and McElroy out there speaking for him, are pretty smart moves.
Mm. And what did you make of Pope Francis's call for Pope Leo's call for a ceasefire?
We've been there. Agree with Ambassador 100%, and it was a very solid statement, and it is continuously growing in its strength, and I think we're going to continue to see that because the situation is becoming more tragic, more dire by the day. The war continues, and there are several elements that Pope is taking into account, but I have to say it is primarily pastoral. Many times think about the local population, think about the people, not so much about the leaders making the war.
Mm. Ambassador, being that Pope Leo is the first U.S.-born pope, all eyes are on how he is engaging with President Trump and the Trump administration in particular. He has so far avoided direct mention of the United States when it comes to the Iran war. But how would you describe Pope Leo's approach to U.S. engagement at this point?
Well, I think he's carved out a good territory in opposing the invasion, and that's what it is. Of a country that didn't really threaten the United States. And I think that getting the other cardinals out front speaking for him in the United States is a good idea because he needs to be above the fray inside the United States. And I think he's got that down. The other thing he hasn't addressed yet is that nobody else in the world is engaged in this conflict except Donald Trump. And sooner or later, he's going to say that, and it's going to be really good.
Inez, how do you think Pope Leo's time in Peru shaped his diplomatic approach? What did that experience expose him to regarding international relations?
Me?
Specifically?
Yeah, I think it was formative. I've talked to him many times during his stints in Peru. And becoming a dual citizen and knowing the country so well as strengthening his sensitivity to the poor, were formative expressions for Pope Leo, not Father Bob. I think that helped him with the world in getting elected, that he was seen as a citizen of the Latin America as well as the United States.
And Inez, how would you answer that question? How did Pope Leo's time in Peru shape his diplomatic approach?
in many ways, especially feathering, I think, in the fact that he believes in a diplomacy that is bottoms up. Again, he's primarily concerned about the people, those who are suffering. He's talked about many times about, think about what Jesus is doing to the women and to the children and the Christian populations that have already been suffering for decades now in the Middle East. And we're talking about cardinals in Syria, cardinals in Lebanon, Cardinal Pizzavala, talking about we're going to be out. We're going to disappear there where we're first born. And I have to say, though, I agree with the ambassador in that he was very smart in using two American cardinals to speak up about the war, but also from the get-go in letting Cardinal Parolin openly challenge the idea of having a preemptive war when it comes to the situation in Iran, which is, this is what it was, let's bomb Iran just in case.
I want to hone in on this very point. You both have brought it up about how other cardinals are speaking out. Ambassador, I want to bring this question to you. Cardinal Robert McElroy of Washington, D.C. has been very outspoken that he believes the Iran war does not meet the just war criteria. And Cardinal Blaise Cupich of Chicago has openly criticized the Trump administration's characterization of the war. So do you, in fact, think it is part of Pope Leo's diplomatic strategy, actually, to allow these cardinals in the U.S. to speak even more forcefully than he is about the war so that he can preserve those diplomatic channels? What do you make of that interpretation of events?
I think it's very smart of him to use his organization, especially in the United States, where they are, where they're interacting with the media every day, and he can be a little bit removed from the fray. There's no doubt that this invasion does not comport with the just war theory. There's no proportionality to it at all.
And as another whole factor about what's going on, there have been a flood of fake videos and images generated by AI that have overrun social media networks and stirred up chaos online recently. The New York Times identified more than 110 unique AI-generated images and videos from the past 2 weeks about the war in the Middle East. It seems to be yet another repercussion of modern-day warfare today. And as can you reflect for a moment how Pope Leo in particular is uniquely equipped to respond to this modern day challenge?
It's fascinating as a Catholic to know that from the minute he was selected, he knew he needed to address AI and the fact that we're going through a Copernican revolution that it's even bigger than what the Industrial Revolution did in terms of how humanity and people are perceived and seen. He's been a solid voice from the beginning. We know he has a document coming out, which is going to address how Catholics need to think about artificial intelligence. And he will, I think, continue to be that voice. He talked about it even when he addressed journalists and whenever he's talking to communicators and his message for Communications Day. There is a big warning there that needs to continue. But also for those of us who are in the media, who are in communications, who are big and strong in social media, there are ways to engage even those who fall prey of the artificial intelligence videos. And it's not just through hatred. It's not just through confrontation. But actually, when he's talking about engage in dialogue, it means we too need to find the correct words to engage those who believe that fake news and AI is a way to win a war unfairly.
Ambassador, I'm hoping you can shed some insight onto this. Does the Vatican opposition meaningfully influence U.S. decision-making? Even if Pope Leo were to be even more forthright and direct, how much of a difference would that actually make?
I think that the Holy Father's pronouncements and the pronouncements of the church leaders here about this war and about AI and things like that will resonate with Americans. May not resonate with this administration. I'm not sure what does. But with Americans, it will. And there's a big article in the Washington Post this morning about a series of Catholic theologians discussing the necessary role of humanity in AI decisions, particularly when they involve war.
Yeah. This is an increasingly critical issue that we as a church need to grapple with. And as finally, Pope Leo held an audience with a group of Italian broadcasters earlier this week, and he cautioned them about their coverage of war. Let's take a listen to part of what he said.
Always, but especially in the dramatic circumstances of war, such as those we are currently experiencing, the media must guard against the risk of becoming propaganda.
And as a journalist yourself, I'm curious if anything stood out to you from our Holy Father's remarks. And it does seem that Pope Leo really does understand the great influence the media can have in times like these.
I think it was brilliant the way he portrayed. He was very strong without being chastising the journalists. He was giving us an advice on how to better do our job, not just tell us, hey, you're doing it wrong. Let me explain why. I think that was very important in terms of engaging with communicators. And something myself I have often practiced and preached as a journalist or as a communicator is always go to the source. And if you don't have the source, then question it. And if you don't know what you're talking about, then don't say, yes, I'm going to talk about it. Don't write about things that are way outside of your comfort zone. I can easily talk about Pope Leo and diplomacy, but specifically, for instance, even in this conversation, if you wanted me to drill down on what's happening on the ground, I only have so much access to information, and that's what I'm comfortable with speaking.
That's a great reminder for all of us in journalism as well. Ambassador Rooney, and SN Martin, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And there is much more ahead on this edition of EWTN News in Depth. Religious persecution takes a sharp new turn in Nicaragua amid a situation that was already precarious. And
if you want to bear fruit, you have to embrace the cost of discipleship.
A longtime Catholic archbishop reflects on his life's work as he heads into retirement. We go on the record with outgoing Denver Archbishop Samuel Aquila.
This is the relic of a beloved Peruvian saint, and Pope Leo, the night before he became a bishop, was here in prayer. I'm Jonathan Liddle, and we're in Sunya, Peru, and that story is coming up.
EWTN News in Depth continues its series of reports on the life of then-Bishop Robert Prevost in Peru and the influence his South American missionary work has had on the man we know as Pope.
The Archdiocese of Denver is receiving a new shepherd. Next week, Bishop James Golka will be installed as the Mile High City's newest archbishop. Archbishop-designate Golka, a native of Nebraska, has served as the bishop of the Diocese of Colorado Springs since 2021. As the sixth Archbishop of Denver, he will oversee northern Colorado's nearly 600,000 Catholics. He takes the helm from Archbishop Samuel Aquila, who has led the Archdiocese of Denver since 2012. Pope Leo XIV accepted his resignation in February. Prior to this transition, Archbishop Aquila spoke to EWTN News in Depth about his time shepherding the faithful in northern Colorado as the fifth Archbishop of Denver. His discussion with EWTN reporter Francesca Fenton revealed his pastoral heart for his people. Here's Archbishop Samuel Aquila on the record.
Archbishop Aquila, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
I wanted to start with, as you prepare to conclude your ministry here at the Archdiocese of Denver, what first comes to your mind when you look back on these years?
As I look back on them, there's deep gratitude for the priests, for the religious, the deacons, the laity, and just seeing the real growth in faith that has taken place here, and people's deeper relationship with Jesus Christ and with the sacramental life of the church. And it gives me great joy to be able to see that. And also, I was ordained a priest for this archdiocese back in 76, so just seeing the fruit of so much of my own ministry, both as priest, as bishop, and archbishop, and it's a great blessing.
Denver has also been blessed with really strong vocations. What do you see as the key to fostering priestly and religious vocations today?
I think in terms of vocations, and certainly we have been blessed, and part of that is very intentional work on our college campuses and in our high schools, and of having discernment groups in them for young men or young women who may be discerning a vocation, so that they're meeting once a month together, they're praying together, and then encouraging people to pray for vocations. I pray for vocations every day in the Archdiocese of Denver specifically. And I ask the Lord, you know, please plant in the hearts of young men in the Archdiocese of Denver, as the harvest master, the seed of a diocesan vocation, or plant in the hearts of young men and women the seed of a vocation to the consecrated or religious life, or plant in the hearts of young men and women the seed of a vocation to marriage and the beginning of children. And I really believe that much of what we are seeing in the numbers of vocations is because of prayer, not only my own, but that of the faithful, that of other priests, deacons, religious, and laity who pray regularly for vocations and talk about it. And we're not afraid to talk about it. And because it's an incredible life, it's a true gift from God, and it's what he desires.
As you prepare to hand over the Archdiocese to Bishop Golka, what advice would you offer him?
I would really encourage him to continue the missionary aspect that we've begun here, keeping our eyes focused on Jesus Christ and really our surrender to him. I have strongly promoted the surrender novena, praying the surrender prayer of Charles de Foucauld, or the Anima Christi prayer, and making it our own personal prayer. And also the last words of Jesus on the cross, Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. That total trust and surrender to the Lord. And so continuing to encourage that. And because that's what builds fruit. Because the Lord makes it clear, when we abide in him and stay attached to the vine, we're going to bear tremendous fruit. And when we don't, and when we start proposing things that are very human, or things that seem, well, you know, let's try this, or whether it be, you know, contraception, whether it be women in the priesthood, whether it be abortion, or any of the other types of things that other Christian communities have embraced, and they're not bearing any fruit. If you want to bear fruit, you have to embrace the cost of discipleship and live that costly grace of giving yourself completely to Christ and following in the steps of Christ. And so I would just really encourage Archbishop Designate Golka to continue with that. And I know his heart's there, because I've known him for the last 4.5 years and have had meetings and conversations, and that he understands that we are living in apostolic times that needs that missionary spirit, and to continue to build on that.
This year marks your 50th anniversary as a priest, with four decades of those being here in Colorado, in Denver. How has your relationship with Jesus changed, deepened, all of the above, over these 50 years of your priesthood?
Certainly the intimacy level is much deeper. After I became a priest, I started making 5 and 8 day Ignatian retreats annually, and that really helped me to grow in my own faith, in putting my trust and confidence in Christ. And certainly my image of God changed from a God who was more or less one who was always checking his little black book and seeing, you know, well, how many holy things did he do today, and how many sins did he do today, and to one of deep love. I trust in the Holy Spirit much more profoundly, and all of that has grown, because early on, as a young priest, I really didn't pray too much to the Holy Spirit or to the Father, for that matter. It was all Jesus-centered, but Jesus wants to lead us to the Father. He wants us to live in the communion that he lives with the Trinity. And so all of that has grown deeply in the last, and only continues to grow.
And what does retirement look like for you?
I'm not sure yet.
Okay.
It'll be an adventure, I'm sure.
If you would like to watch Francesca's full interview with Archbishop Aquila, it is available right now on the EWTN News YouTube page. News headlines are next in the Week in Review.
My goal in 6 months is that we're not in the lead story every single day. My goal is for people to understand we're out there, we're protecting them, and we're working with them.
A confirmation hearing on Capitol Hill this week to find a new leader for the embattled Department of Homeland Security tops the Week in Review. The department remains unfunded in a partial government shutdown over a congressional dispute about its immigration enforcement tactics. President Trump fired controversial Secretary Kristi Noem and nominated Republican Senator Mark Wayne Mullen to replace her. In his confirmation hearing, Mullen was asked about his immediate defense of fatal DHS shootings of two U.S. citizens in Minneapolis before the facts were in.
You, sir, you called Alex Preddy, quote, a deranged individual that came in to cause max damage. Could we expect those kinds of quick responses if you are confirmed as secretary? Would you be basically, will you? You did. You responded as Secretary Noem. Are we going to just expect that same behavior all over again?
Those words probably should have been retracted. I shouldn't have said that, and as Secretary, I wouldn't. The investigation is ongoing, and there is, like I said, there's sometimes going to make a mistake, and I own it. That one, I went out there too fast. I was responding immediately without the facts. That's my fault. That won't happen as Secretary.
Despite some tense questioning on additional issues, including concerns about his sometimes angry temperament, the committee on Thursday advanced Mullen's nomination to the full Senate. A final vote to make him our next Secretary of Homeland Security is expected next week. Mullen would lead the nation's third largest department, one tasked with continuing the White House's hardline immigration policies. Rome's trial of the century, the high-profile finance case of Cardinal Giovanni Angelo Becciu, is headed for a partial retrial. The Vatican Court of Appeal has found key parts of the original proceedings were invalid due to procedural issues. The cardinal, who has been one of the highest-ranking Vatican officials under the late Pope Francis, was found guilty in 2023, along with several others, of embezzlement, abuse of office, and conspiracy in the wake of a failed investment of some £350 million in a luxury London property, a move that lost the Holy See more than 130 million euros. On Tuesday, the Vatican Appeals Court agreed with the defense attorneys that the case was compromised by incomplete filings of evidence and procedural irregularities. Dr. Matthew Bunsen, editorial director for EWTN News, explains the court's order does not reverse the verdict against Becciu.
What this does say, however, is the Vatican's appeal court has genuine concerns about several elements of the way the investigation was conducted. For the Vatican, this is something of a legal embarrassment, obviously, but it also raises some interesting questions about the effort on the part of the Vatican to be as transparent in the conduct of this investigation as possible.
While confirming the continued legal effect of the original judgment, the court ordered prosecutors to refile the full body of evidence by April 30th. Becciu was the first cardinal in modern history to be convicted by a Holy See court. The Vatican has released the official schedule of Pope Leo XIV's first apostolic journey to Africa next month. In an 11-day itinerary to four countries, he plans to bring a message of hope and peace to the continent. Pope Leo will touch down in the Muslim-majority country of Algeria on Monday, April 13th, the homeland of his order's founder, St. Augustine of Hippo. The Holy Father will then travel to Cameroon, where Catholics make up about a third of the population, and then to Angola, where he will visit the site of a popular Marian devotion. The final leg of Pope Leo's trip will bring him to the Republic of Equatorial Guinea, Africa's only Spanish-speaking country with a unique Catholic identity. Pope Leo will return to Rome on Thursday, April 23rd. In the latest act of religious repression, Nicaragua's dictatorship has banned the ordination of priests and deacons in four dioceses, worsening the country's shortage of priests. The dioceses are led by four bishops exiled for criticizing the regime of President Daniel Ortega and his wife and co-president Rosario Murillo. While ordinations are still permitted in five other dioceses, the ban makes it difficult to replace priests who have been banished, expelled, or have died. 7 out of 10 of the priests in the city of Matagalpa have been exiled or banished. For years, the dictatorship has intensified its persecution of the Catholic Church, expelling all religious sisters, severely restricting processions, and even monitoring parish priests. Joining us now from Miami, Florida, is Father Marcos Somarriba, who fled Nicaragua as a teenager during the Sandinista Revolution and was granted public asylum in the United States. He's today a Catholic priest in the Archdiocese of Miami and serves as pastor at St. Agatha Catholic Church, which has become a spiritual hub for the growing Nicaraguan diaspora in the Miami area. Father, thank you so much for joining us. First, what is your reaction when you heard that priestly ordinations are now banned in your native country of Nicaragua?
It is really sickening. I think it's an invasion of privacy and also like a violation totally of religious freedom. And because just to say to a diocese, you cannot ordain deacons to priesthood, especially in the four dioceses that there is no bishop. Mm. So they want to become the bishops. They want to select it, but they cannot ordain them. But it's a way like to oppress them. It's a way to keep them like under their foot, the boot, I will say. And I think it's very, very abusive on that aspect. And I think the world should know. And I'm here like with your help and all that to make them aware of this reality.
Yeah.
You know, it seems like you're living in China that you have to approve bishops and stuff like that. In Central America, you know, a Catholic people, Catholic nation, you know, and it's very sickening. And I had a few notes, you know, of things that I was thinking this morning early, you know, and I think is the government is a deeply concerned development, both for our religious freedom perspective and in terms of its broader implication of human rights too.
Mm.
You know, the Catholic Church historically been a vocal advocate of social justice. They always defended the people. They always served the people. And bottom line, we are not politicians. We're not another party, you know, that wants to run in the elections. Right. You know, we elected the people of God, which is our entrusted to us and the church.
And
in Nicaragua.
Yeah. And Father.
And Nicaragua is one bad example of how the government infringe into the religious freedom.
And this is just the latest instance of persecution against Catholics there. Can you tell us more about what is the reality that Catholics face in Nicaragua today? How severe is the persecution against the church?
I think they are imposing by the arms and the oppression and the persecution a silence. Hmm. Faith, silence, silent faith, I will say. And they are like, you can do whatever, you know, you want in the temple, within the temple, but you cannot talk about political prisoners, people in jail, exiled people. You cannot use the word liberty, or freedom, democracy, because they're like watching the priests. They're like videotaping them with the phones, you know. There's like people from the government attending mass, like checking them out in their homilies, and then they call them out to the police station. And not only that, they have people assigned from the government and the police that are going after the police, checking them out. Like, where are you going? Are you going to another town? Why you didn't let me know? And what are you going to preach this weekend? I want to see your homily. So it's really, really, really like, you know, it's really chaotic in that aspect.
And Father, can you explain to us, why is the Ortega regime threatened by the Catholic Church?
Because they're afraid that where we talk and we speak is human rights, and they want to step on human rights. They are afraid of all speaking of freedom, of faith, because the church is the only entity that is calling out all these injustices, denouncing, as is our duty as prophets, you know, to denounce any injustice to the people, This began in 2018, like more than normal. Mm-hmm. And it was very sad, you know, because they killed a lot of young people who were protesting. And they went after them in the middle of the night. And they pulled them out of their homes and they disappeared them. They burned them. And there is, like, you know, a human rights, information of all these young people. I have a lot of young people that come here to my parish that were in the protest, you know, they're doing on the streets, and they had to run away of the country because they were like, either this is the theme that they have, either you're with us, because if you're against us, you're dead, or you leave the country.
Wow. Father, would you like to see the Trump administration take any specific action against the Ortega regime? Would you like to see something similar to what we saw in Venezuela, for example, with the capture of Nicolas Maduro?
Well, that's not my call to do and to suggest to the government to invade Nicaragua and to pull them out. But I think if they act in human rights, because what these people are committing is crimes of lesa humanidad. That is like a really, really, like, you know, that doesn't expire. And I think the government, Marco Rubio and also like Mr. Trump, the President Trump, are aware of this threat to the United States. Mm-hmm. First of all, it's a threat to our society because they have been the carousel or the means by which a lot of, like, you know, terrorists and criminal people that went through Nicaragua. I remember knowing situations like they would arrive to the airport, they would take them in taxis to the borderline to Honduras, and they would release him there. And some of the people, they get passports, Nicaraguan passport, like Venezuela did, you know. And so we don't know who is here that is a terrorist. You know, I'm afraid there are like sleeping cells in the country.
Wow.
So, and you talk about it, you know, Nicaragua is friends with Khomeini. I mean, he's dead now. Mm-hmm. With Iran, you know, looking always for support and money from Russia. They have a lot of Russians there, like the Venezuelans had Cubans in there. Mm. So everything is like either you are with us. Either you shut up, you be quiet, don't raise any issues about human rights or liberty or freedom, because we are the only one. And they use the Christian language, you know, to say that they are like a peaceful nation, loving nation, that God is blessing them and all that. And that is really, really, really an offense.
Mm. We have less than a minute left, Father. But I did just want to ask you your sense of how Pope Leo XIV is responding to the persecution of the church in Nicaragua. I understand he had a message to exiled Nicaraguan Bishop Silvio Baez, who now celebrates Mass at your parish.
Well, he said, you know, you need to go back and celebrate Mass there. And you need to, like, speak up your heart and your mind. Your name and your last name is an antibody to their system. You know, so keep denouncing, keep fighting for immigrants, and keep defending them and voice, be a voice for your people.
Mm.
That's what we do.
Well, Father, thank you for being a voice with us this week. God bless you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. God bless you.
On the Solemnity of St. Joseph, hundreds of faithful gathered in prayer once again for the 21st National Catholic Prayer Breakfast on Thursday in Washington, D.C.
Eternal Father, I offer you the body and blood, soul and divinity of your dearly beloved Son, our Lord Jesus Christ.
This year's theme, One Nation Under God, celebrating the Catholic contribution to America's 250 years. The event featured guest speakers, including actor Jonathan Rumi, who led the room in praying the Divine Mercy Chaplet, and Claire Lai, the daughter of imprisoned Catholic activist Jimmy Lai. Keynote speaker Michael Knowles spoke about how Catholics helped to shape America, while special guest House Speaker Mike Johnson defended the role of religion in public life.
Here we find ourselves. A quarter millennium later, a people and a place so improbably and perfectly suited for each other that not only can a Catholic become president, but an American can even be the Pope.
As we rededicate ourselves to the cause of our founders, we should turn toward prayer again, just as they did. And why? Because it strengthens and fortifies.
About 1,500 guests from across the country, including about a dozen U.S. Catholic lawmakers, attended the morning event. It's time for action for those who want to take part in the next National Eucharistic Pilgrimage, taking place from Pentecost through Independence Day. The historic spiritual journey will travel the East Coast in conjunction with America's 250th anniversary and is a continuation of the National Eucharistic Revival of 2024. the St. Francis Xavier Cabrini route begins on Memorial Day weekend in St. Augustine, Florida, near the site of the first Catholic Mass in the United States. The Blessed Sacrament will then be carried through many of the original 13 colonies through New England. The pilgrimage ends in Philadelphia on July 4th. Stops along the entire route will highlight the rich history of Catholicism in the U.S. Registration opened this week for those who wish to take part in pilgrimage events in one or more diocesan locations. For more information, visit eucharisticpilgrimage.org. When we come back, more Pope Leo news, including the story of the relic that the Holy Father venerated in Chiclayo, Peru, the night before he became a bishop.
And the same relic that we are appreciating, the Pope Leo was also praying.
We take you to Peru to learn more about Pope Leo's devotion to a special saint.
Pope Leo is calling some bishops to Rome this fall for a special discussion on the role of families. He made the announcement on Thursday, the 10th anniversary of the late Pope Francis's controversial apostolic exhortation, Amoris Laetitia. The document on marriage and family was published in 2016 after two contentious synods on the family, which featured debates over divorce. The document sparked controversy with a footnote that suggested divorced and civilly remarried Catholics could receive Holy Communion, quote, in certain cases. In his announcement this week, Pope Leo steered clear of that controversy, instead writing that Amoris Laetitia's call for new pastoral methods for families is more important than ever. The presidents of the world's bishops' conferences will meet in Rome in October. Pope Leo has a new place to live. The Vatican has announced the pontiff is now in residence in the Apostolic Palace after its lengthy renovation. The traditional home for popes before Leo has not been in use since Benedict XVI resigned in 2013 because Pope Francis chose instead to live at the Casa Santa Marta guest house. For the first 10 months of his papacy, Pope Leo had been staying in the apartment he occupied while he was a cardinal. The papal apartment was last renovated in 2005 and needed an extensive plumbing and electrical update. It includes several bedrooms, a dining room, and a private chapel. And the window from which the Pope appears every Sunday to deliver his Angelus is a window in the Holy Father's private study. The feast day for one of Pope Leo XIV's favorite saints is this Monday, March 23rd. This year marks the 300th anniversary of St. Toribio of Mogrovejo's canonization. The missionary saint is especially celebrated in Peru, where then Father Bob Prevost formed a special connection with him. Our colleague Jonathan Liddle, managing editor of the National Catholic Register, traveled to Peru to learn more.
The day before Pope Leo XIV became the bishop of Chiclayo, Peru, he spent the night in prayer, not at the main cathedral in the heart of the city, but here, in the dusty, half-forgotten town of Sanya, keeping vigil with a relic of a beloved local saint known as the Apostle of Peru. This large leg fragment belongs to Saint Toribius of Mogrovejo, a 16th century archbishop called Santo Toribio in Peru. Father David Farfan is the pastor of the local parish in Sanya, and he brought us into the chapel that houses the relic for a closer look.
This is the oratorio, we call. It's the very holy place where we have the relic of Toribio. And the same relic that we are appreciating, the Pope Leo was also praying.
And on that visit in 2014, the future pope even asked to borrow pajamas so he could spend the entire night praying with the saint.
And the following day, he officially took the office as a bishop in Chiclayo.
Why did the American missionary turned Peruvian bishop have such a love for Santo Toribio? Because in many ways, he was following in his footsteps. Like Pope Leo, Santo Toribio was sent to Peru as a missionary. Born in 1538 in Spain, the lay canon lawyer was nominated by King Philip II to become the second Archbishop of Lima. Toribio was ordained, consecrated, and sent to the New World in 1579. Upon arrival, he translated the catechism into local languages like Quechua, defended the rights of indigenous peoples, and walked thousands of miles across Peru to evangelize. Father Farfán sees several connections between Santo Toribio and how Pope Leo served as Bishop of Chiclayo.
Both of them knew that they were foreigners. And the kind of approaching people when you are a foreigner and understanding this, because I was a missionary too, is not imposing things, but understanding, listening.
Father Farfán also cites Pope Leo's focus on community, Marian spirituality, and social teaching as traits that he shares with Santo Toribio, the patron of Latin American bishops.
So many similarities.
It's incredible, yeah.
In fact, a poster at the local parish describes Pope Leo as having a corazón toribiano, a heart of Toribio. And Pope Leo is keeping his devotion to the Peruvian saint alive in Rome. When the bishops of Peru visited in January, Pope Leo told them that it was providential they'd come during the third centennial of Santo Toribio's canonization. He held up the Peruvian saint as a model of fidelity to God's word and evangelistic zeal, and encouraged the bishops to be close to their people, so that what was said about Santo Toribio could be said of them, that he felt so much love for everyone that he held them in his heart as if he were the father of each one. The bishops left Pope Leo with a gift, a tondo depicting the saints of Peru, including, of course, Toribio. As a bishop, Pope Leo returned often to Sana, which is about 30 miles outside of Chiclayo, especially for celebrations on April 27th, a Santo Toribio feast day in Peru that commemorates the transfer of the saint's body to Lima. Because although Toribio's final resting place is here in the capital city's cathedral, he actually died in Sana. Alfredo Perez, a local historian, led us to the place where Santo Toribio was originally buried in 1606. As he explained, in his time, Santo Toribio turned Sana into a beating heart of missionary activity in Peru.
Según la historia, el pueblo obtuvo 18,000 habitantes, una ciudad 100% religiosa.
The traces of some of the 14 different religious orders that were present are still visible today, including Pope Leo's own Augustinians, who lived in this massive convent. However, a series of disasters, including pirate attacks, flooding, and earthquakes, devastated Sana over the centuries, leaving the city once known as the Seville of Peru is not much more than a ghost town today. However, with Pope Leo expected to make a Peruvian homecoming later in 2026, there is hope that the Holy Father will visit his beloved Sana once more. The regional government has even started designing plans for a visitor center and event venue at the tomb of Santo Toribio. And locals are excited about the potential impact of a papal visit.
Si Dios lo permite, visitando nuevamente el Perú y visitando nuestra parte de Lambayeque, traería mucho el desarrollo, el turismo se alarmaría a nivel de la religiosidad que ya está sucediendo en Sana.
If Pope Leo does visit, he'll likely stop by to see his old friend, Santo Toribio, a local saint who Peruvians believe continues to inspire their former bishop, now as the Pope in Rome.
He already is following his steps. And I believe and I pray to Toribio, who showed to them what he needs to do more for our church, because still we have so a long way, you know, to continue offering Jesus Christ to the people.
From Sana, Peru, Jonathan Liddle, EWTN News in depth.
St. Toribio, pray for us. And that's a wrap on this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Next week at this time, foreign correspondent Colin Flint will bring you a special report, Christianity in Lebanon, a Rock of Faith, which explores Catholic life, conflict, and the resilience of a new generation. And then the following week, as we approach Easter, we will air EWTN's special Holy Week programming in place of this program. We will see you back here in 2 weeks. Until then, God bless.